Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Shall we play a game? War Games gets rebooted. Hands-on with the Galaxy S9 Plus and the World's Fair Nano. Live from the Twit East Side Studio in beautiful downtown Petaluma, it's the new screensavers, Faith and Agora.
I'm Father Robert Bellow, sir.
Oh, Father! Father, I had a terrible night last night.
Oh, what happened?
We'll save the priest jokes for later. Happy St. Patrick's Day. It's the new Screensavers, recorded March 17th, 2018, episode 148. I'm Leo Laporte, leprechaun.
Yeah, I'm the digital Jesuit.
Father Robert
Not
Ballister.
A leprechaun.
He's not a leprechaun. But he'll tell you a story about a ladle that'll curl your toes. Coming up on today's show, I have in my hands, but I'm not sure which is which, the new Galaxy S9 Plus, my review, plus Kelsey Weber from iFixit. She's going to show us what's inside.
Also, this week, it actually marked the passing of two important figures.
Yes.
In the tech science community. That's right, we're going to be talking about physicist Stephen Hawking and, of course, Adrian Lamo. It's a sad week, but also a week for reflection.
Yeah. Well, we have a price here. It'll help us get through it. Also, Echo, EKO, is a company that produces and streams interactive shows.
I stayed up late last night.
Watching War Games.
I got hooked.
You did?
I did.
It's a remake of the classic 1983 classic War Games. Alon Benari, their chief creative officer, will join us to talk about how it works and what's coming up from them as well.
Yeah, and our very own Jason Howell and producer, that guy, Anthony Nielsen, went down to San Francisco to check out the Nano Fair. It's a tiny, tiny little fair. Yeah, and we're gonna show you some stuff from that.
We also have Jason. Oh, yeah, you talked about that. Let's see. And Call for Help. I have to follow the list here. We'll talk about ways for checking insecure iOS devices on your network.
Plus, we've got some fun stuff in our mailbag.
Yes.
But, Leo, you know what I like to start the show with?
Topics
that are hot on St. Patrick's Day.
Big story. Now, it's kind of interesting because The Guardian had this story a full year ago. We talked about it at the time. I know a lot. A company called Cambridge Analytica, which is owned by the Mercer family, and was run at the time by Steve Bannon, a couple of people with connection to the Trump campaign and now the Trump administration. Cambridge Analytica was used by the Trump organization to advertise on Facebook during the election, and some credit with getting Trump the win. But an interesting thing has appeared. Apparently, Cambridge Analytica used an illegal method to gather information about 50 million Facebook users.
Right.
We've talked about this before. I've warned you about Facebook quizzes. You know that quiz, you know, which Game of Thrones character am I? When you take those quizzes, not only are you giving the company that made the quiz information about you, but thanks to Facebook's terms of service, which is skeezy as heck, you also give them information about your friends.
Right. It's all about your circle. Who's there? Who's linked to you? Who's connected? You're passing on all that information, and that's the food for the big data machine. And I have to say what you will about the 2016 elections, Trump's campaign used big data like no one has ever done before, and it was all through Cambridge.
Yeah. Now, here's the issue. Cambridge commissioned a questionnaire. We think they have many of them, but this is the one that they got in trouble for, and then took the information they got from that questionnaire, not just about you who answered it, but their friends, which means almost 50 million Facebook users, and took that information, exfiltrated it, and used it illegally against Facebook's terms of service and, frankly, against privacy regulations in the UK, which is where they're based, used it illegally to help Trump's campaign. Facebook has only now, a year later, booted them off. So Cambridge Analytica is now off of Facebook, but it really raises an important issue for anybody who still uses Facebook. And I have to say, this is yet another nail in the Facebook coffin. It makes me really, because Facebook knew about this, they had rules. They said that friends of friends stuff has only been supposed to be used to improve your product. It never. It was always used for other data gathering purposes, even if this was so-called illegal behavior. A year later, they, after denial and denial and denial, they finally boot them off. I don't trust Facebook. I don't like how people use Facebook. You not only should you not answer questionnaires on Facebook, but you shouldn't be on Facebook.
Yeah. Well, the issue is social media networks that are incentivized financially to break their own terms of service. So it's one of these, well, yeah, you shouldn't have been doing that, but you're still paying us, so I guess we're going to drag our feet. And that is such a dangerous precedent to take, because remember, go back 10, 15 years when the whole social media craze started, the trade-off was, I will give you some of my personal data in exchange for this awesome service, for Gmail, for Facebook, for Twitter, whatever it might be. But back then, we didn't really understand how our own information could be used against us.
Right. Well, I think you nail it there. There was a deal made, an implicit deal made. I will trust you. I will give you data. I will trust you to keep that data safe. The minute Facebook breaches that trust, which they have now.
Multiple times.
Many times, but this one's proof positive. That's when I say enough.
Yeah.
And, I stopped using Facebook months ago. I think a lot of people have. Now I'm thinking maybe I just need to get off Facebook entirely, because even if I don't use Facebook, I'm careful about my use of Facebook. A friend of mine decides to find out which Game of Thrones character he is. He's revealing my information to that company. That's a real problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was 5 years ago. All of the information on my Facebook profile is fake. The only reason why I have a Facebook profile is because there are some services that require me to have Facebook for proper authorization. So I do that, but I don't use it anymore. It's not my social network. I just don't trust them. And once you lose the trust, I don't think you can really get that back.
One good thing is you can now not only cancel your Facebook account, but permanently delete your data from Facebook, thanks to the EU's GDPR regulation. That's going to take place, and that's going to become a law in May.
And that's absolutely crucial, because what GDPR does that no law in the United States does is it has this sliding scale. Because most of the privacy violations that have taken place, they have been slapped on the wrist with what, like a $100,000 fine?
Big deal.
Who cares? If they're making $1 billion from it, they'll take it. But what GDPR does is it says, no. We can penalize you up to a certain percentage of your profit for the entire year.
Good.
That hurts.
I think I'm going to go home tonight and kill Facebook. That's what I think. And by the way, that means Instagram, because that's Facebook. That means WhatsApp, because that's Facebook. And I think we really have to look hard at all the other social networks, too, and really start to see, are they misusing our trust? The minute they do, that's it. Let's see. What else is big in the news? Drake. Drake's big in the
news. Drake's always big, right?
What did Drake do?
Well, Drake decided to get on Twitch to play a game, and he didn't break the records. He destroyed them. Yeah, that's right. They got him together with some other players, and they knew it would be big. They had no idea it would be this
big. So he played Fortnite with Tyler Ninja Blevins, who is, by the way, very, very popular. But the minute Drake gets on there, hundreds of thousands of people.
Over 600,000.
600,000 converge on that channel, breaking the previous tournament record of 388,000. The all-time Twitch record, according to Polygon, held by a league major, Boston 2018, with 1.1 million concurrent viewers. They didn't break that.
No. But they smashed most of it. And, he's not a gamer. He's not a gamer on a game.
Did you watch?
Well, I stopped in because it was blowing up on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, okay.
There's the blue-haired guy is Ninja.
Player.
Yeah. And where's Drake? Is he? We're going to see Drake.
No, we can fast forward to find Drake. This is just what it looks like when people drop by to watch a stream.
I actually enjoy watching Fortnite. We watched it when we were benchmarking the iMac Pro. One of the great things about Fortnite, it's a battle royale. One of the ways to play it. There's other ways, but one of the ways that most people play it is battle royale, which means 100 players drop into a zone and the last man standing wins. And the thing is, I get killed right away.
Weren't you going to get it on iOS? Didn't you have to be invited?
It's coming to iOS. I've asked for an invite. I haven't gotten it yet. That would be fun. I think it's a really good game and fun to play. But I am not good, so I die right away. But that doesn't matter, because then you watch the person who killed you until he gets killed. Then you watch the person that killed him. So you can watch the entire rest of the game till the last player, and it's fun.
You know what? So it encourages you to root for the person who killed you, because you want them to win it all. So you can say, hey, at least I got beat by the champ, by the best.
That's a sad state we're
in. So, Drake, good job. That's like telephone, but with Twitch.
This is, though, what happens when real celebrities mix with internet celebrities. You see the difference in scale.
I would love to see if Twitch kept data on how many of those concurrent streams came from people who are always on Twitch watching streams, and how many came from new users or guests.
Drake fans who would
never watch a stream, but if it's Drake, yeah, they'll be there.
Yeah, Drake's from Canada.
You know what else I want to talk about, Leo? I want to talk a little bit about cryptocurrency.
I have a new one I'm going to tell you about. By the way, this guy is a Dogecoin millionaire.
Well, that I should have sold that. It was worth
something.
Has it gone down? It's back where it should be, which is, I think, my Dogenaire fortune is worth like 60 cents.
Big problem, though, and it's not true of all cryptocurrencies.
Correct.
But a big problem with Bitcoin is that the mining of Bitcoin and then the proof of work required for a transaction uses energy. And now, because Bitcoin's pretty far down the road, a lot of energy.
A whole lot.
Bitcoin uses more energy than the country of Poland now. And soon we'll use as much energy as we do in the United States. For that reason, Bitcoin miners, the people who do both the mining and the transaction proof of work, like to be somewhere where electricity is cheap. Mostly that's in China near hydroelectric
dams.
That's
the only way to make it affordable or make it doable is the cost of electricity has to be less than the cost of, than what you can sell that coin for.
But there is one place in the United States of America where it makes sense. It's in New York State, and they're near a hydroelectric dam, and the energy there is 4 cents a kilowatt hour.
Yeah.
Not free.
Not free, but almost, basically.
Pretty cheap.
Yeah.
So the city is it Plattsburgh?
Plattsburgh.
The city of Plattsburgh, New York, is imposing an 18-month moratorium. No Bitcoin mining in our town!
Well, it's more nuanced than that, because what they're really going after are the commercial Bitcoin mining operations. I mean, they can't stop the odd person who's mining Bitcoin on his gaming rig in his bedroom.
They can't.
But well, they can try. It's really difficult. What they can stop, though, are new permits from commercial companies that want to come in and take advantage of that electricity. What they're finding is that the average rate of the electricity bill for the people who actually live in the city has increased $100 or $200 a month because of the way that they purchase power. You see, these Bitcoin operations came in, and they used up so much power that Plattsburgh went over its power budget, which means it needed to buy energy on the open market, bumped up the rates for everybody. Now, here's the fun part. One operation, I think it was Coin Mint or Coin something, one operation used 10% of all the power going into that city. So they said, we just can't do this anymore. So it's a moratorium on new operations until they can figure out how to deal with this. And honestly, I expect to see this kind of moratorium or ban expand, because more and more cities are saying, why are we paying for your use of energy if you're not contributing to our tax base? That makes no sense to us.
Yeah. All right, but now, does Dogecoin use that much energy?
Dogecoin would, except, I mean,
it's so small.
It's so small.
So the way the way Bitcoin and its derivatives are designed, and this was intentional, is that it gets harder and harder to do the proof of work as the number of coins in existence goes up. And I think that was the theory, was not so that people wouldn't just mine it and kind of create deflation. So there should be some cost to making it, in
Correct.
Other words, and the cost
Correct.
Should go up as the value goes up. However, there are some cryptocurrencies that don't have that problem.
Yes, and actually we talked about one on This Week in Enterprise Tech about 3 weeks ago. It's not based on a proof of work, because the proof of work is what takes up all the power. It's based on proof of stake. It's the same idea. You need to have some skin in the game in order to make the currency worth something. It's just, where do you get the skin from? Do you get it from the resources required to compute something, or do you get it from an actual investment in the currency?
Now, of course, Dogecoin is great, but because he owns so much of it, we're not going to promote Dogecoin.
No.
But what was this other one?
Well, there's the two big ones are Bitcoin and what is it?
Ethereum.
Ethereum, that's
it. Monero.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm interested, and the reason I'm interested, and we mentioned this on Twitter on Sunday, the reason I'm interested in this, because people I trust and know who do the Keybase website, I've gone in partnership with Stellar Lumens. Are you familiar with lumens?
I am not.
This is a cryptocurrency that I think is... Now, I don't have any lumens. I'm not pumping this up. But the idea is this is does not use a lot of power, has very low transaction times, resolves in 2 to 5 seconds, and will continue to do so even as it grows. That solves a big problem with Bitcoin. It also has some other benefits that, you know, fix the Bitcoin algorithm. I'm very intrigued by this because I do think that blockchain, a decentralized crypto ledger that is secure and is not owned by any one institution.
It's a very promising technology.
It's promising.
Yes.
So I don't want to throw Bitcoin out with a... Wait a minute.
You don't want to throw blockchain out with the Bitcoin.
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute. What?
You're not wearing any green.
Oh.
Do you not know what day this is?
Black contains green.
I get to pick... Well, you know what? I'm going to give you a choice. I put green on by wearing... Black does not contain green, by the way. That is a big, fat lie. White contains green. You got a white collar.
I should have colored the collar.
All right. You should have.
Okay.
I am going to give you a choice.
What am I doing?
Here you go. Here's some green hats. I have a lot of green hats. See if you like that.
Oh, hey, Bowser. I'm down with a Bowser-ish cap.
All right.
What else you got? What else?
Well, I have a green do-rag.
Ooh.
I think that might make you kind of thug. There you go. The thug priest. Or you might like this, the Iron Man World Championship.
That I have never seen more of a mismatch than me wearing an Iron Man cap. I better go with Bowser.
Okay.
I think Bowser's my jam.
Jerry, Jerry's also wearing green already. Would you like... Uh-oh, Anthony, you need a cap.
He could actually do the Iron Man
You should
cap.
Do the Maker Faire do... Oh, you aren't the Iron Man? Yeah, he is kind of an Iron Man. Oh, too bad.
Don't.
It fell.
There we go.
Oh, rats. Okay, I wanted him to wear the do-rag. Lisa, that means you have to wear the Maker Faire do-rag.
I feel kind of like she's wearing.
There you go. Now we're properly attired. Bowser.
Those bells are going to drive me crazy.
All right, let's get to our review of the day.
Yes.
And this is the new phone. This is the funny thing. I still have a Note 8. And on the face of it,
Turn theirs to me.
I can't tell the difference between the Note 8 and the Samsung Galaxy S9. There is a difference.
There is. I mean,
one's a little bigger.
A tiny bit bigger, so I'm saying this is probably the Note.
I think
maybe.
You're right. You could tell as soon as you turn it around.
Because there we go.
The Galaxy S9 is in lovely purple.
Or turn it to the bottom, because one of them has a stylus and one of them
and
doesn't.
One of them doesn't.
There you go.
Yeah. But there isn't that much difference, frankly, between the Note 8 and the Samsung's Galaxy S9. I can't decide which one I want to carry. I have to say I really am liking the S9. They fixed one problem that is a big problem with previous Samsung fingerprint readers. On the Note 8, they put the fingerprint reader next to the camera.
It sounds like a good idea,
but it was never the right place. It was also weird feeling. They finally, on the S9, they've moved the fingerprint reader where it belongs, kind of below the camera in the middle. It still feels weird because it's square. That's not the shape of my finger, but it's okay. It works. I think the reason it's this way is when you first register a fingerprint, you can swipe this. So unlike Apple, where you have to keep tap, 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 one swipe is enough to register the full fingerprint.
That's interesting.
So I think I think that works pretty well. This is a dual camera if you get the S9 Plus. And one of the things that's really interesting, it has a mechanical iris.
Yes,
so a two-blade shutter that opens and closes the lens to give more light or less light. F1.5, which is the fastest of any smartphone.
They had a great demonstration during the big Samsung event where they turned the house lights down and it was still able to take a very nice, clear exposure.
I have to say, the camera on this is very good. DxOMark gave it, I think, a 101,
wow.
Very high mark, which means it's basically equivalent to a DSLR. On the other hand, if you look at each individual rating on the S9 Plus, there are areas where the Google Pixel 2 XL beats it. There are areas where the iPhone X beats it. So I would just say they're all roughly the same. Some have, you know, this is probably better in low light, for instance. It does have a thing that they've made a lot of hay out of, which I think is completely stupid. In fact, somebody called me and said, my wife really wants to get an S9 because of this great Animoji thing doing. They call them AR emojis.
It's a disease we've inherited from the eyesight.
This comes from Samsung, from Apple. So what I'll do, let me see if I can do this. You get your face in there, and for best results, remove glasses and clear away hair. It may not like the hat.
Yeah, and
smile with your lips closed and give it a whirl. So it's now going to, male or female, what do you think? I'll choose male for today. And then it's going to create an emoji. Now, this is rapidly goes into the uncanny valley. This is what it thinks I look like. That is a not...
That's the hat shadow.
No, yeah. That's my hair. I could choose different hair, by the way. You can even change the face a little bit. I don't think that looks more like me. Let's choose some different hair. What do you say? I'm definitely a gray guy, so I'm going to put gray hair on me, right? You could change the face a little bit. Does it look like me? Oh, I like the curly hair.
I mean, in the sense that that's it has skin, and you have skin. Yes, I guess.
You know, I didn't have glasses on, but I could give myself some nerdy frames if I want to.
I don't think...
No.
This is not doing it for me.
No frames? How about a better outfit? That is the worst outfit. What is it, a peanut? It's crazy. That says figure.
Now you've got like the Steve Jobs attire.
Yeah, isn't that? That's very Steve Jobs.
That's the Ellen DeGeneres attire.
There you go. I kind of like that. I do look like Ellen, don't I? It's Sergeant Pepper's one
that's
and only
Amy
lonely.
Pond.
Yeah, or Michael Jackson. Oh, now I'm in Cheap Trick. I'm the schoolboy. Yeah. I don't know. I can't decide.
See, here's the thing, though. That is a very market-specific feature. If you go to Korea, everyone's doing this.
They're dressed like that?
Well, no. I mean, they love this animoji thing.
Oh,
They love being able to do that. Here, we don't really care. It's an oddity. We probably do it just to see how it works. I don't see me using this on a daily
basis.
This
is what
basis.
I ended up choosing is a suit and tie.
No, you look like Bill Clinton.
I do. I did not have sex with that woman.
Wait.
Okay, so that's one thing. I wouldn't buy it for that. On the other hand, super slow-mo.
Okay, this...
I want you to do something fast.
Ready?
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. I got to get you. See where the square is, Jerry? That's what we're going to try to get the action. And press the record button.
Get the gels out.
And start recording. Go. Now, don't record too long because it's 960 frames a second. So it means 1 second's going to play back. What is that? Let's see. Let's see what happens.
I might have given myself a concussion.
With Father Robert and the... Oh.
Wait, that was regular.
Hey.
Wait.
Hey.
Hold on.
This is going to autoplay.
Where's my super slow-mo?
Yeah, see, it's not doing the super slow-mo. Am I doing something wrong?
Did I concuss myself for nothing?
Yeah, let me... Oh, but meanwhile, this is my feeling about that.
Aww.
Actually, it's kind of...
so sad.
It's kind of fun.
They actually brought the slow-mo guys onto stage, and they did a demonstration.
Well, apparently we should have got the slow-mo guys in here. Why is it not slow-moing? The slider? I don't see the slider, though.
This is a failure of UI, folks. The super slow-mo is one of the most anticipated features on this.
I was able to do it earlier.
It's really easy to get.
Yeah. Maybe at the three dots, you think? I need to do
the one below the play bar.
The play bar. Where's the play bar? I don't see any play bar.
Okay, we need technical support. Is there anyone from Samsung in the chat room who could tell us how to kick off the super slow-mo mode?
Oh, those three dots.
Yes.
Well, here we go.
All right, let's go back to Father Robert. Clearly, we have now figured out the mystery. Stop. Okay. How do I get back to...
See, this is what I don't like. They changed the interface just
so confusing.
So that what used to work doesn't work anymore.
And there is no after-the-fact super slow-mo.
No.
Oh, well. No. You get the idea. It's okay. It's cool. 960 is really amazing. I don't think there's any phone that goes that slow. And they say it makes everything awesome. Yeah, if you happen to have this, it's great. But it's not, you know.
People aren't shooting in 960 just for giggles. You're specifically
setting up
a slow-mo mode.
That, in a nutshell, is really what's wrong with a lot of what Samsung does. It's great if you like a lot of controls, a lot of buttons, a lot of switches. It is sometimes a confusing UI because it does so much. The Samsung camera has super slow-mo. It has AR emoji. It has wide selfie. What are you saying? Wide selfie. What do you mean, wide selfie?
That's mine.
it has a deep focus, depth of focus. Hold your phone at arm's length for best result. Look at, see now, Jerry's out of focus. That's actually a great selfie. Wait a minute. All right. I take it back. I love this phone. All right. I'll tweet that so you can see Jerry out of focus behind me. You can make stickers out of it, all sorts of things like that. Now, it is a Samsung Exynos in the rest of the world, but in the U.S., yeah. It's a Qualcomm Snapdragon 845. That's the new super fast Qualcomm. It also has the gigabit radio in it. And I think this phone will support, I'm not sure, will it support 5G?
I mean, it's going to eventually.
I'm not sure if it has that capability.
I know.
What does it even mean?
So,
yeah. There's something also in here that I find very intriguing. Samsung's always had a heartbeat monitor that's actually quite accurate in here. See that underneath the flash? There's a little electronic sensor. It actually will measure your heart rate. And I believe it will also, and this would be huge, Samsung is not talking about it yet, it will do blood pressure. And here's why I believe it. There is a study from the University of California at San Francisco to measure body and mind activity. And they say we're measuring, in fact, I'll do it right now if you want, we're measuring your blood pressure. Put your finger on the sensor.
Chair with your back straight.
Sit down to measure. And I'm going to cover the sensor back here. But what it doesn't do is give you... It doesn't give you the, I'm not supposed to make any noise, so this is going to be a bad reading. It doesn't give you the blood pressure it's reading, or maybe it will in a few weeks. That's kind of unclear. But if it can capture blood pressure.
Yeah, the problem is you have to stay still and you have to have it in the perfect position.
But that's true of any, I got to do some more. Let me do it again. So that's true of any blood pressure reading. I mean, a cuff is a little bit more forgiving. But nevertheless, if you can do it just sitting still.
Well, it's like what the health devices, the watches and the Fitbits have done for just basic heart rate and body temperature. It's now giving us more data points throughout the day that are very easy to do. So why wouldn't you? If you have a longer picture, a longer image of how your health is over the course of a day, you can make much better judgments.
So this says, and I don't think University of California, San Francisco would lie to me. Great, we've captured your blood pressure. Now, it's going to ask me a few questions. Oh, my blood pressure is high right now. It's 5.5% over baseline.
Oh, you are presenting.
Who's currently with you? No one, stranger, family, or friends. Stranger.
Oh, okay. See, that gets kind of dangerous. Now, it's like, okay, who affects your blood pressure?
How are you feeling? Positive and activated, negative and activated, positive. So this is going to be not a longitudinal, a wide area study with lots of people, they think, I guess, using the S9. I think that's pretty good. I'm feeling positive and activated. How intensely positive? Active, like, are you doing something that requires concentration or attention? No. Are you enjoying what you're doing right now?
You got a shrink in your phone.
Do you wish you were somewhere else? No. Do you feel like things are overwhelming right now? Well, a little bit. Do you feel like things are unpredictable? Oh, my God, yes. And so now I've done a body and mind check-in. I think this is going to be very interesting. This is a free app you can download. You do have to sign up. You're giving data to UCSF. You might want to think about that.
Right.
But it opens this really interesting notion that maybe this is not just a heart rate sensor, but can also measure blood pressure. The way it works with the heart rate is shining light into your finger and watching the flow of blood. That would be intriguing.
It's a wellness sensor.
It's a wellness sensor. The phone is snappy. It's fast. Yeah. I immediately take off the Samsung customizations. You see, I'm using NovaFill Launcher. Actually, I'm using Active Desktop, an alternative launcher, because I don't like TouchWiz. But to their credit, Samsung has not larded this up with a lot of weird third-party stuff.
Thank you.
I was able to buy this unlocked day one. That's fantastic. Price is much better. For a 9, it is $720. For a 9 Plus, it's $840.
We were not expecting that. We thought $1,000 was going to be the new price.
Yeah. Samsung, as usual, has the biggest changes are in the settings. But there's some things in here that Samsung does that I think are really cool. The advanced gestures. I love it in the sound. And this is something only Samsung does, to my knowledge. You can customize the sound. That's not quite it. Let's see. You can customize the sound for your hearing with Adapt Sound. So it actually does a hearing test. Or you could just say, I'm over 60. You can give it your age. But I did a hearing test. It generates a custom sound curve based on your actual hearing. So there's my hearing. And you can see as an older person, my high end is attenuated. And so what it'll do is it'll equalize all the sound that comes out of this phone, particularly the sound that comes out of the headphone jack. to
super advanced technology.
Yes.
And it is still waterproof, yes, even with that headphone.
Yes. Oh, and there's plenty of room to put all sorts of features in here. Yes. Samsung has the courage to keep the headphone jack. So it is an EQ for my hearing, mm-hmm, which means sound on this is fantastic. Now, they do have, they say, Atmos sound. I think Dolby's just selling the brand name get the word out. And they do have, they say, stereo sound out of the speakers. But it sounds like any smartphone. It's tinny. It sounds like a bad transistor radio.
You can't beat physics. Small speakers make tinny noise. That's how it works.
So all in all, I have to say, the camera's great. The phone is fast. Samsung has really, you know, as over the years has been doing this, eliminated a lot of the weird stuff that they do with TouchWiz and made it, I think, a pretty clean Android experience. It is Oreo. It's not 8.1. It's 8. It doesn't have the March security patches, which my Pixel does. It only has February. But I think Samsung's going to pretty much keep up with the security patches. I have to say, if you don't want to buy the Pixel, which is my favorite, the Pixel 2, mm-hmm, this is the Google phone, this is an excellent phone. And DisplayMate took a look at the screen. They say this is the closest to perfect we've ever seen, the best screen we've ever seen. And I have to agree with them. Nobody does it like Samsung with their OLED screens. And they don't sell Apple their best screens.
No.
They really don't.
They hold back. And, you know, I'd say if you're looking for a flagship phone right now, if you're in the market, this is a great choice. But if you've got an 8, or even if you've got a 7, this is not a huge upgrade.
Yeah, that's what everybody said. But on the other hand, there's some nice features in
there
here that you might want. I think if you've got a 7, you should definitely upgrade. 8, you're right. And if you've got a Note 8, it's hard to tell the difference. By the way, let me just show you. With face recognition, Samsung decided the fingerprint should stay, but they did put face recognition in, and they did something Apple doesn't do. They matched face recognition with iris recognition.
Ooh.
And it's really fast. So watch. I'm going to do the face recognition to get into this. You'll be watching. As soon as I turn on the button, a red light will come on. That means face recognition is in process. And there it is.
Wow. Wow.
And I think that they've solved any security issues by matching iris and face recognition, kind of double biometrics. That makes me feel really good. If it's dark or, you know, you can't see me very well, fingerprint, I don't have to ever enter a code unless I want to. You will want a PIN because that encrypts the data. I got to say, I think they did that right.
Yeah.
Now, on the line with us from iFixit, as always, we really love getting Kelsey Weber on because when they go out and they get one of these phones, they take it apart, and you did it again, Kelsey. Hi, welcome.
Yeah, so we took apart the S9 and the S9 Plus this week, and I took apart the S9 Plus live on Friday, which was fun, but a little bit scary doing it live for the first time. And we gave both of them a 4 out of 10, which was the same score that we gave the S8s.
That's actually not bad. What's the iPhone X's repairability score?
A little bit higher, and that's mostly due to the opening procedure on the Galaxy S's. So on an iPhone, you take your phone from the front, and you can pop open the screen, which is the first thing to break. So it's great that that's the first thing to come out. And then the battery and everything else lies beneath. But on the Galaxy phones, you have to open them from the back. So you have to take off the back panel, and then you get inside, and you can see the motherboard and the battery. But you've got to go through that whole process in order to replace the screen on the front. And because of those curved edges, that's going to be really difficult to do without, you know, breaking the phone in the process.
Now, I have to say, to Samsung's credit, they have added same-day repair. It's like it's a company called iRepair iPhone.
Thing. Yeah, I think it's You Break iFix.
You Break iFix. Yeah,
which is great. You know, we advocate for the right to repair in community, and so it's great to see them working with more private repair shops. But if you're going to give the repair information to You Break iFix and help them out with
give it
the
to everybody.
Proprietary tools. Give it to everybody.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So the right to repair just got introduced in California. So hopefully we'll start to hear from more tech manufacturers
Very good
and what
news.
They feel about that.
So let's see what's inside. I am so impressed that you did this live.
Yeah.
That's nuts.
I know. If I had to go back and do it again, and if people did watch the live stream and watched us kind of struggle with it at the beginning, all I'd have to say is just use more heat. There's just so much adhesive on this back panel, so we were kind of fighting with it for a second.
I love it. You get out the heat gun, you get out the pads, you heat the whole thing, you cook it. Finally, the glue gets soft.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to take it all apart?
So on the live stream, it was about an hour. But if I used more heat, it would have cut down the first probably 10 or 15 minutes of struggling there.
Is that Gwendolyn with you on that?
So that's actually KK. So Gwendolyn was our host previously, but she's moved with her family. And so now KK and I, and then we've also got Alex, who's our Apple Watch expert that comes on the channel.
You guys are great. I really enjoyed watching the stream. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Thanks so much. But, you know, like you said, it's kind of hard to tell the note apart from the newest Galaxy.
It is. They look the same.
Yeah, it's even harder to tell apart the Galaxy, the S8 Plus from the S9 Plus once you get inside. But I've got the two back panels here to show you.
That's how you tell the difference. Yeah. There's only one purple.
Well, and the vertical orientation of the camera
that
cluster.
I really do like the new fingerprint reader so much better. So much better.
I feel like, I mean, I use a pop socket on the back of my phone, so I feel like maybe if I had rear, you know, that would work better on my phone. But I also feel like I just keep smudging the camera, and especially with this, like, fancy new, like, dual camera setup, I feel like I'm just constantly, like...
Samsung actually put software in that said, don't forget to clean your camera, because so many people had smudged it.
Now, is there glue holding the battery in, or once you pop the back off, you can remove the battery pretty easily?
No, so there's glue holding the battery down, and unlike what we see in iPhones actually have these kind of pull tabs that you can use to release the adhesive underneath, and we don't see that in the Android, in the Samsung phones. But I use a little bit of adhesive remover to get in there, because if you can see, it's in a really tight compartment, and there's not a lot of room to pry around, and... I mean, whenever I see this, I just think back to the Note 7, and maybe if these batteries were a little bit more replaceable, you wouldn't have had to recall so many. Yeah. You could have just, you know, swapped out the batteries for people. Mm-hmm. But so we don't see, so that's another reason for the lower score compared to some iPhones, is we don't see repairable, you know, features like that, like the pull tabs.
3,500 milliamp hour battery. Not a very big battery for such a big phone. But it's adequate, I guess. Yeah,
and it's the same. Yeah, same size as what we saw in the Note 7. The S9 and S8 have the same size, and the S9 Plus and the S8 Plus, batteries have the same capacity.
Right. Okay. So you're going to get the same battery life you had before, pretty much.
Same battery life. Really, you know, like you all mentioned, that dual camera setup is what is the new thing inside Plus. Yeah.
So tell us about that.
So we've got the dual cameras, and on top is the camera that's got the dual aperture, which is actually the widest aperture that we've seen in phones yet. So I think the previous phone was the LG V30 that I think had 1.8 or something like that. So you should be getting incredible photos with this, and it's the first time we've seen the dual camera in the Galaxy S series. So they've had it in the Note, but it's the first time in the Galaxy S series. So I guess if you use the camera and you think it's worth the upgrade for photos, that would be really what people are looking for.
But aside from that camera cluster and the fact that the battery is glued in, it's really the same inside, right?
The same inside, even the same screen size. And so the opening procedure is familiar to us because we tear them apart all the time. But if the average consumer wanted to go in and swap out their battery, it's a pretty tough process to do the first time around.
Yeah, I'm very nervous anytime I have to try to tell people that they should be using a heat gun near a battery or even a syringe filled with adhesive removal. That's a really good way to start a fire.
Kelsey's a trained professional. Don't try this.
Yeah, and our adhesive remover, you know, we've perfected it in a way where it's, you know, not going to melt the plastic around the battery. It's not, you know, as long as you, you know, use your safety precautions, disconnect the battery, you know, while you're doing your repair. And we've got step-by-step guides for that kind of thing, so you don't end up in a fiery mess.
Were you able to determine what all the chips were? Any mysteries in there?
Not any major mysteries. We do have the full chip ID over on the teardown, and I've got the motherboard I have now isn't D-Shield, but we do work with some people to get that full chip ID done.
Right. So once you send it into them, they could figure it out.
Ooh.
There's a list of them. Yeah.
And if you have any, or if anybody out there, anybody can go on to our teardowns and comment and update them with either, you know, information, chip ID, stuff that they know. And then we go through those comments and filter and update the guide, because all of our teardowns and our repair guides are actually wikis on the site. So you can create your own and help improve the ones that are there.
I'm a fan. It has that Qualcomm acoustic DAC on it, which I'm actually a fan of. I think Qualcomm's doing a good job with the software in there.
Did they use Toshiba NAND flash on the 8?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can look back
it
on
it. It did say Toshiba, yeah.
They wouldn't use their own parts.
Yeah.
That's a little strange. Okay.
And people often ask us that, and we just chalk it up to a supply. You know, depending on your location, sometimes your chips are a little bit.
Remember, Samsung's NAND company is really a separate company.
Yes.
So they contract out. They go to Samsung, their partner, and say, well, how much would you charge? And if Toshiba's going to give them a better deal, or they can offer the 30 million chips that they need, then they're not necessarily going to get it from Samsung.
That's
true. I think that's just how it works.
A lot of chips.
Yeah, it's a lot of phones. I think they're going to sell this one very well. Of course, a 4 out of 10 isn't the best repairability score, but it's kind of par for the course these days.
It is now, right.
Yeah. As you know, phones now, even in iPhones, we see the glass sandwich. You've got glass on the front and the back.
Yeah.
The back panel for Samsung devices isn't so hard to repair or replace, and there are, you know, lots of those out there. But, you know, for the iPhone, getting that back glass off is really tough. So, we'll, you know, with the glass, although you get, you know, wireless charging, some of these other features, you put a case on it because you really don't want to break it. And you especially don't want to break it once you're outside of your warranty, because that's when repairs can get expensive.
Okay, Kelsey. Little AR Leo says, okay. Thank you very much. Get a case, in other words, because it's not going to be easy to fix this, and it's glass, and it's going to be easy to break. Kelsey Weber, iFixit.com. We love you guys, longtime sponsor of the show, and we always love to see what the teardowns reveal. And, of course, the ultimate goal of all of this is to make the ultimate repair guide for the internet world. You can get repair information and tools and parts for just about anything at iFixit.com.
Yeah.
It's yours. You should be able to fix it.
Yeah.
And we're going to have more solutions for Android users coming up. I think a lot of people go to iFixit for, you know, Apple devices repair, but stay tuned because we've got more stuff coming for Android users as well.
We didn't talk about California, but you think that's an important thing that they passed that right to repair legislation?
Yeah, so it just got introduced and we're going to be following it closely. You'll probably see us, I'm sure, up in Sacramento giving testimony when the time comes. And hopefully, just like we saw with auto manufacturers back in 2012, it took one state to pass a state law that turned into a federal policy that required them to share all that information. Repair information. So we're hoping that, you know, California will be the state. We've got 18 states on board, up from 12 last year. We still haven't had anything passed, so we're working on it.
Oh, so it is not yet a bill. It is a law. It's just a right to repair bill. If you're in California, you should absolutely contact your assembly member and tell them, pass
you can go to
this
basic right. I should be able to do things with the stuff I own.
Yeah, you own it. Go ahead, Kelsey. Yeah. What were you saying?
No, saying you can go over to repair.org. We work with them to get these laws and things passed. And you're right. You bought it. You own it. You should be able to get it fixed as you please. And I know that manufacturers want to protect their IP, intellectual property, but you can still allow people to repair their stuff and protect your property at the same time. So that's what we're asking for.
Exactly. Kelsey, thank you so much. iFixit.com. Kelsey Weber, take care.
Yeah, thanks so much.
We'll have you back next time something new that we can take apart.
Sounds good.
Take care. Instead of watching the show, what if the show watches you? We're going to talk to the chief creative officer from ECO about their interactive movies and programs in just a little bit. But first, a little earlier, Anthony and Jason went to see the World's Fair Nano. We've got a two-part report from them. Here's part one.
If you're looking to catch a glimpse of the future, then you'd be hard-pressed to find an event that showcases a taste of what the future might look like better than the World's Fair Nano, which actually took place in San Francisco this last weekend.
What's it like being a drone?
We began our journey exploring some of the more modern methods of transportation. Leaf Tech, for example, offers a skateboard with a unique wheel array underneath the deck that helps the board ride like a snowboard.
Imagine we're going down a cab track. You're going to pull up to the lift and you just do your little slide stop like you're about to get on a lift, okay?
But I've got no slide because I'm not on snow.
You're thinking about this. You gotta see the snow. That's why I made you close your eyes. Yeah.
On the other hand, the folks at Geoblade offered a high-tech hoverboard that, well, let's just say it rides quite a bit differently than what I was used to. It was pretty hard for me to adjust to.
My brain isn't working.
Don't bend your knees.
Okay, that's different. Because when I go snowboarding, I bend my knees.
Yeah, this is the only board.
Ah, so
bend your knees.
Got it.
The beauty is that once you've got it, you're both hands free.
It makes it look easy. I give up.
Now, we've all been to the airport and, you know, needed to go from one side to the other. And let's face it, all that walking can get a bit tiring after a while. Well, the team at MotoBag actually have carry-on luggage that magically transforms itself into a vehicle when needed.
So you lock it in place, pull these out, you turn it on, and off I go. Two speed settings, love 5 it. Miles an hour and 8 miles an hour. You can go a range of 10 miles on a single battery charge.
Hey, it works. Not bad.
That's all fine and good, but let's go from the now and step into the true future.
We might be the same height, but you're just a little bit more enhanced on the feet region. What's going on down there?
Cheating a little bit. We have the Bionic boots here.
Not necessarily a consumer product at the moment, but this amazing exoskeleton developed by Kihei Seymour allows for superhuman running speeds.
It's a pair of shoes that makes a human run at 25 miles an hour. Our use of passive energy springs. I'm looking towards future advancements with servos and actuators to boost the performance to 45 miles an hour.
Running boots, world manifest.
The World's Fair Nano also offered a glimpse into the ways technology plays with the mind. Virtual reality continues to trend upwards, and the Hologate team has been rolling out its turnkey multiplayer VR setup in recreation centers across the country.
Well, the idea is it's a social experiment. You know, we want to have people actually be together and work together as a team. We have haptic feedback lights. We have screens that are not just first person, they're actually third person cameras that are, you know, different around. Everybody wants to play this.
As evidenced by the line to view the technology, which sprawled out to a 2-hour wait for the entirety of the day. Ever played a game with your mind? If the puzzle box is any indication, mind control could become quite a big deal as the technology develops. In this case, a player's focus is measured within the mechanics of the game, and that focus will actually fire off the propellers of the encased flying machine.
You're going to raise this red bar up until it hits the target. Once it does, that will trigger the helicopter to take off and fly just like that. And as long as you stay focused,
what?
Stay in the air, and if you get distracted, it's gonna land.
Replicating that, however, was an even bigger challenge.
I see it getting so close, and you're nodding. You're like, yeah, you almost, oh no, no. Cinema snow globe, shake it, and it plays a video inside. You may think I'm talking to you right now, but I'm watching a movie.
Build your own vibrator. Yeah. Jason! You stopped too soon! Well, guess what? There's part two of this coming up later. Will he or won't he?
I was going to go to that. Unfortunately, I was in Orlando, but maybe it's good I wasn't there.
I just think it's great they found a new way for me to crash drones.
I know. So now you can think it and then crash it.
Right. If you think it, then you can crash it. Jason will be back with part two of his visit to the Nano Fair. But first, let's talk about war games.
Yes, please. Shall we play a game?
I remember we had a great time interviewing the director of the original 1983 movie. This is on the old screen savers, John Badham. Fascinating story. He brought a book, a photo book that he had of the movie and stuff. It was really great.
I had it on Laserdisc.
Yeah, who didn't?
That movie defined my childhood.
You bet.
It's kind of weird, but yeah, Matthew Broderick.
On a Mitz Altair computer.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Shall we flip a switch? Anyway, it's been updated. The 1983 War Games now is a 6-episode interactive series, hashtag War Games, from Echo, E-K-O.
Born with a duty to serve others.
Here's a little trailer for it.
New information paints the death of Sergeant Elizabeth Grant in a whole
so
new
it's,
light.
It's the same sort of thing.
Is it different story, though?
Different story, but it's the same kind of thing of someone doing something just for lulls, just for hacks, and then getting deeper and deeper and deeper and realizing there's all these unintended consequences.
War is my favorite.
You're sitting down.
He looks like Matthew Broderick.
He kind of does. But she's Lightman. So her online name is Lightman. It's the war machine. So David Lightman was the character from the original movie.
Right. So she's actually the guy.
Right. Now, some of this, you can kind of tell it falls victim to what they need to do in order to make this work.
Right.
But it actually was fun. I watched the entire thing several times over.
Well, let's get Echo's chief creative officer on the line here. Alon Benari is one of the people behind War Games. Launched Thursday. How's it been going? You getting some traffic?
Yes, going very well.
Yeah.
It's live on the web and on Steam and on the App Store.
How long have you been working on this?
So it's probably been in the works for a couple of years, but actual production for the past few months. This was directed by Sam Barlow from Her Story fame. He's a game creator.
Yeah, right.
And he kind of brought this new vision. And I don't know, I'll jump right into it. I'll say I think it is different from the original one, but he because you guys know hacking has come a long way since 1983. And it needed a different treatment, I think. But there's something about like naive kids who think they can change the world and start by doing silly stuff and end up being involved a bit over their heads is still the core story here.
I think you almost need a game designer, though, to do interactive fiction like this.
Right.
Because it's challenging to think in those nonlinear ways.
What's interesting is when this was pitched to me, the producer of the show, Anthony, came to me. He said, oh, this is like a choose-your-own-adventure. And so the first thing I watched on your site was literally a choose-your-own-adventure type series where it would stop and you would make a decision and then you would see the consequences. This is different. And that's what I liked about it. This was far more nuanced. There is never a point at which you're saying, I'm going to do the good thing or I'm going to do the bad thing. It's always about what you're paying attention to. So based on which screen you're watching primary, that chooses your path. I love this approach because it's far less intrusive.
Yeah, so Sam, his vision was, listen, it doesn't need to interfere with your viewing. And as you said, kind of pause, pull you out of it, ask you what you want to do. This is about you just enjoying it and paying attention to whatever is interesting to you. And the show kind of tracks what you're interested in because different people are interested in different things. And maybe your Kelly is more interested in the, you know, in the silly side of hacking. And maybe your Kelly is much more political. And the story can kind of steer in different directions and you will end up getting different outcomes. But it's much more implicit and you can't really easily just, you know, play it differently. It's kind of reading your mind.
That's the other thing. That's the thing I love about this. It's difficult to deliberately pick a different pack because you're hardwired to pay attention to the things that you're interested in. Like, for example, and I'm not going to put out any spoilers, but there was one scene in which you had the main cast and they're watching a TV host and they're trying to get an opportunity to get information from her. And there's one screen that's sort of like the security camera outside of the host's house. And I was drawn to watch that. I mean, I was watching the other windows in the periphery, but that was my primary window. And I realized, wow, I'm kind of a voyeur. I love watching security cam footage. And that made my choice for me.
Yeah. Like we look at the data, and it's actually very interesting because in a given scene, there are people who are interested in looking at the news, mm-hmm. and there are people who want to see the drone hack, mm-hmm. and there are people who want to see the 14-year-old kid who's goofing around and saying kind
That's
of
what I would click on.
Yeah. Borderline appropriate jokes, right?
So yeah, see, like this scene,
went for the security cam.
I was all about the security cams.
Yeah. Yeah,
and you can still hear the story unfolding, but I was flipping back and forth between the security cams, and that picked what happened in the show for me. I love that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because there must be something going on in Hollywood. Steven Soderbergh just released an HBO show, Mosaic, that a few months ago was an iOS app that you did exactly that choose your own adventure thing. And I agree with you. It kind of
it stopped,
and then you had to decide what you wanted to do, and it didn't have the flow to it. So mm-hmm. I can see why you wouldn't want to do that. But I just find it interesting that Hollywood is, again, looking at new ways to tell stories.
Yeah, yeah. Although, I wondered several times, how many branches do you have to film in order to make this work? And do you film, like, every scene, do you film it 10 different ways? Because I couldn't keep it straight. As an actor, I couldn't remember, okay, I was happy, or I was sad, or I was very distressed. How do you keep it straight when this comes to production?
So I won't guess, you know, spill the whole secret sauce, but of course you need to kind of keep it contained production-wise. I will say something that you said before, that we are involving people who created games in the rooms, and we're bringing people who have a background in writing, you know, TV and film, and combining them with people that have a background in writing interactive, because there's a lot of know-how in the gaming world. Look at, you know, Telltale Games and the like. People have been figuring out in the gaming space how to tell stories in a way that is compelling and still interactive. And what we're trying to do at Echo in War Games and in other shows that are coming soon, how do you take that kind of narrative structure but bring in proper writing, proper acting, live action footage, and topics that can appeal to a mainstream audience and not only to gamers?
As soon as I played with it, I thought, this is a really interesting playback platform. Yeah. Because you have these, as you could see, thumbnails, and you can click on one and it zooms in. Is that HTML5? How are you doing that?
So that is the Echo Player. It is HTML5.
Wow. I know it's not Flash. I know that much.
Yeah, so I can tell you kind of the brief history of this. We started as a tech platform. My background is a TV and filmmaker in Israel, and the founding team of Echo is actually musicians, and we started by making music videos. Huh. And our original player was a Flash player 7 years ago, and I think 5 years ago we switched to HTML, and we have a very robust kind of coding language for video that allows any type of interactive storytelling that ranges from, you know, stop, choose, to this that is much more advanced. We have a tool that is open to creators, and we're working with high-end creators both from the film industry and the gaming industry to create these.
How can somebody, if somebody wants to use this tool, what do they do?
Yeah, exactly here. If you scroll up a bit, back to the top, you see that Join Echo Studio button?
Mm-hmm.
You click, that'll take you to a free tool that allows you to just drag and drop and create your own shows, and you can publish it, and you get an HTML iframe that can play on any device that has a browser. And this, interestingly enough, is the developer's site, because there's a code panel in the tool.
Yes, I see it.
If you're not happy enough with the drag and drop options that are, you know, out of the box, there's a whole overlay of JavaScript that you can add in anything that you want. And War Games was built exactly like that. There's basically a canvas solution that is overlaid on top of our player that allows for switching the windows in real time. And this works on Xbox, on Steam, on iOS, on Android, and desktops.
So we could make a multi-branch episode of New Screensavers that just ends with us on the floor.
Because
we've made too many bad decisions.
4 days to make one show. What is the ratio typically of hours shooting to hours of entertainment you get out of this?
So I'll start with the kind of the good news. The outcome is that people spend an average of 2 to 3 times on your content.
That's not bad at all. Yeah.
Which on linear video, you know, most people don't even complete. So the fact that they watch it again, my theory is the romantics want to see what would happen differently, and the cynics want to see.
Oh, they go back. They go back and they watch it different
again.
It's like a BioShock.
That's actually
playing
great.
BioShock and then playing it with the opposite choices that you made the first time around because you want to see.
So it has the replayability of a game.
Precisely.
But it's a linear story. I like that. Oh, this is fun. We played this a little bit. This is, you may recognize her as the woman in the AT&T commercials. You're putting her in difficult social situations and then choosing her response and seeing how it plays out.
Yeah, so this is much more of what you would call, you know, standard choice base.
But it's fun.
It is fun.
Even here, it leverages the platform that allows for seamless transitions. You see, it doesn't buffer, reload, stutter, stop.
No.
Even here, as you get this choice, take a look at this. You get the choices, and the video keeps on playing.
She's trying to remember where she met this guy, because he recognizes her. She doesn't.
So, traditional choose your own adventure.
Really?
Yeah, it was when we started a dumpster fire in your mom's church.
What?
What fun. It's a hangman game. I think that's really fun. So anybody could do this. So my son, for instance, just graduated from college with a broadcast journalism degree. I tried to talk him out of it. And he learned, you know, he took classes where they learned standard A-B cutting and ENG news gathering and all that stuff. And he said, Dad, this is awful. This is not how my generation communicates. I said, you got to learn this. But once you get out of school, you can do your own thing. This would be great for somebody who's starting as a creator. Start with this platform and learn how to do this kind of nonlinear stuff. I think there's that's a huge future in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and as you said, I think everybody's understanding, even in the professional, you know, arena, they're understanding that viewing habits are evolving.
Yeah.
technology has got to a point where we all have broadband and we all have, you know, strong computing devices in our hand, as you just, you know, dissected. And every machine can support this. So why not tell more complex and more elaborate stories?
Really, really interesting. Yeah, I'm going to tell Henry about this. I think he'd like to use this. And I think maybe people were watching.
I actually have a challenge for the people who are going to go to your site afterwards. I actually brought up War Games on two machines. And I watch different things on both machines. And you watch, you watch the narrative unfold differently. And you realize it is different. Because the first time you watch it through,
you might think it's actually a linear story with just a different presentation.
It's like, no, it really does change the tone. I loved it. I thought you did a great job.
This is exciting.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I love seeing people play with this and trying something new and something different. So thank you. Do you want to show the Bob Dylan video?
Yes, please.
This is now, who created this? Was this somebody inside of Echo?
So yeah, this was a super talented director called Vanya Hyman. He worked on our team back then. Since then, he moved on to create many other great videos. We did this with Sony.
So here's the Bob Dylan, of course, Rolling Stone, and then you can change the channel.
The song continues.
I don't know how you did this, but somehow their lips,
yep, all synced up,
are matching.
Seems so proud.
I don't know how I did this.
It's fun. This is so much fun.
And these are all real clips, right?
Yes.
That's just bizarre. How does it feel? Mark Maron singing Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Now, did he go shoot Mark Maron doing that?
Yes. So Mark Maron shot himself. We actually reached out to a lot of
people.
To shoot this for us. And thanks to, you know, Bob's Dylan.
Everybody loves Bob Dylan. Anybody would do anything for Bob Dylan. Look at this. This is great. Price. Wheel of Fortune. What is this? Price is Right?
Price is Right.
Yeah. There's a funny anecdote that the Today Show said politely refused. And when this was the kind of viral thing of the day, they actually had an item on this and they brought in the producer who said no and shamed him.
Oh, good! You said you didn't want to do this. Now it's huge. How do you feel?
Adopt, adapt, or die. Yeah.
Wow, that is really, really cool. All of this is on the website, yes?
HelloEcho.com and on the app in the App Store.
Oh, good.
And that's EKO, by the way. EKO.
EKO, correct. And War Games is also available on Steam and on Vudu and soon on Xbox as well.
Oh, that's interesting. You're putting it on gaming platforms as well.
It is a gaming format. Why not?
Yeah. So Sam, the creator of this, his previous work was Her Story, which was a very kind of big indie hit a couple of years ago. And it also treaded the line of, is this a game? Is this a video?
Right.
And he continues doing that.
Very nice. Well, it's great to talk to you. And I think that people should check this out. I'll make sure that Henry checks this out, especially if you're a content creator. I think this is a really interesting platform. I can't wait to see how people use this.
I wonder if they'll let me do multi-branch stories from the Vatican.
You should. Ooh.
Want to film the Pope?
Sure.
Alan Benari, thank you so much. Echo's Chief Creative Officer. Hello, Echo. EKO, HelloEcho.com to see War Games and some other, all these, the Bob Dylan's there as well.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, there's a lot of content on the site. It's not a one-trick pony. Try War Games. Give War Games two episodes to see if you get into it. But all the others are instantly accessible and they're instantly fun.
Yeah, I tried to watch the Steven Soderbergh mosaic. I couldn't get into it. This I could get into. This looks very, very interesting. Great to talk to you, Alan.
The pacing of interactivity is much higher.
I think so. I think there's something going on, too, that I think that there's a new generation that's grown up that linear video is too boring for them.
Makes sense.
They want something more engaging and participatory, and I think this might be it. It's great to talk to you. HelloEcho.com.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Wow. We should make something with this.
We should totally do this.
I don't know, but...
We could do it on Know How. I'll shoot something.
We should have asked, but I mean, how many do you have to shoot, like, different...
I mean, I think important is you got to storyboard it. Because if you just start shooting it's not going to turn out.
Yeah.
So storyboard it, get your branches down, like what kind of outcomes are you looking for, and then shoot it.
Yeah. Very interesting. All right, thank you for that. And now it is time for
Call the Hand.
pre-recorded because they don't have power in British Columbia. I don't know.
Too much Bitcoin mining.
Too much Bitcoin mining. From Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, Canada, Trent.
Hi, Lou. I'm Father Robert. I just bought a new router a couple of months ago. They offered a paid IoT security feature, which they gave for free for a couple of months. Rather suspiciously, about 2 days after the subscription ran out, I got an email from my provider saying that there was some weird activity on my network, and they said it was probably the Mirai, IoT Mirai. Now, I'm not against paying for IoT security, but I was kind of keen to figure out where the hole was and to move to patch it. But the best advice that anybody ever gives is to turn everything off and turn everything back on, change your passwords, and cross your fingers. I don't have a lot of IoT devices, a Nest, some Hue lights, an Echo, and then modems and routers. But I was wondering if there's any way to do the network analysis on these things to find out what's insecure. Is there something like a little snitch for network traffic for these IoT devices?
Now, the first thing I'd have to say is if you go back a couple of weeks on new screensavers, I showed off using a port scanner. Mm-hmm. So you use Nmap, which is a free piece of software that runs on Linux, OS X, Windows, whatever, and it will look through your entire network or even outside networks, although be careful about doing that because it looks like an attack, and it looks for open ports. Is there anything that's vulnerable? Is there any port that's open that could potentially be attacked? But that's just the start of it. He's specifically asking about Mirai. There's a couple of things that he could use here.
We should mention Mirai was the botnet that took down the internet, took down Dyn, a big DNS server, and it worked because it took advantage of unpatched IoT or unpatchable IoT devices,
cameras
and routers, interestingly enough, and would live on that router or that camera. It did not survive reboot.
No.
Which is interesting. But on the other hand, if you got it the first time, you're probably going to get it again because they just kept sending it out over the internet.
They were seeing something. During that first round, they had devices that would drop off the botnet because they were rebooted. But then they would come back up a couple of minutes later because when they were reconnected, they were almost instantly reinfected. Because Mirai went through its main vector of attack was the fact that a lot of these devices have default usernames and passwords
that are
hard-coded.
Not good.
Yeah. That's a really, really good way to make sure that you get owned.
So now I'm curious why he got this the minute he stopped paying this fee to protect himself. I hope that this company did not infect him.
Well, it may be less nefarious than that. It could just be that once he's no longer using the free trial, it's not doing a thorough scan of his internal network. It's just doing a basic scan, and it's going, oh, this device isn't responding, therefore it might be infected with Mirai. It might be infected by Mirai, but it also just might have a firewall.
But wait, he said that the email came from his ISP.
Right.
His ISP saw Mirai. So it does feel like that router was protecting him. And, you know, Mirai is out there. If you have a Mirai-infectable device, isn't it going to get infected? Yes. So maybe he did, in fact, have a vulnerable device, a camera he got from a kind of no-name Chinese company or a cheap router. It wasn't a router, obviously, because he had a secure router on there. And maybe it just didn't get infected because he'd been protected all this time. And all of a sudden, you stop paying for the protection, it's going to get infected. That's the way it works with Mirai. So what can he do? I mean, that's one way, is to look for open ports. Mm-hmm. Nmap. Now, does Nmap know about Mirai? Will it look for the...
No. So Nmap isn't actually looking for vulnerabilities. It's literally just a port
scanner.
What
ports are open?
What ports are open? What services are available?
It will know sometimes, if it's a canonical port, what that port normally does.
Precisely.
So it can identify that. But it doesn't know about what port the Mirai net's looking for.
Right. Mirai might be using 1849. And do you know what a port 1849 normally serves?
No, what?
Anything. That's the idea behind ports. I mean, you can have anything running on any port. That's what makes it so difficult.
Right. And I'm sure it moves around, too.
Precisely.
You're not going to use the same port all the time. So the other way that he should think about this is protecting his IoT devices from the outside world. A, don't buy... You know, and Stacey Higginbotham had it in a nutshell on Twig this week. She does the Stacey on IoT podcast. She writes a newsletter about IoT. She says, I will not buy an IoT device that isn't over-the-air firmware upgradable.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Period. I guarantee you that camera that he's getting infected is not. So make sure it is, and that the company stands behind it. It's going to stay in business and is going to upgrade it. That means you're buying from a big company, not a no-name company. You might pay a little bit more for your cameras and your routers and all that stuff. But it's really important it be over-the-air, firmware upgradable. And then Steve Gibson talks about what to do to protect yourself and your IoT devices. Now, this is hardcore. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about.
The three dumb routers.
The three dumb routers where you make a triangle. I think more and more routers are starting to come with an internet-only
Coming with VLANs enabled. We actually did an episode of Know-How where we showed off how to create a three-dumb router setup.
It's worth watching.
It is worth watching. So you have one router that's your premise. So that's where the internet comes into. And then you use two other routers to create sort of the untrusted and the trusted side.
Okay. You can't just use two routers to do this. You need a third router.
You need a third router because, well... The thing is, you want nothing behind that first router except the other two routers.
See, the problem is these IoT devices basically become a gateway into your home network from bad guys.
Right.
And so if they're on your home network, they are going to give bad guys access to it. So they need to be completely on a VLAN or isolated. It is enough, though, to create a VLAN.
It is enough. A VLAN is not a security feature, but it's a management feature. But for most
traffic
cases,
doesn't usually bridge over from one VLAN to another.
Precisely. Yeah. We have moved from what we used to call the perimeter defense. So perimeter defense really died about 10 years ago.
Because it didn't work, keeping everybody from coming in at all.
All the bad guys stay outside. Now you just assume the bad guys have
They're
gotten
in.
So you try to segment your network so that if something gets owned, your cameras, your doorbell, whatever it might be, it doesn't affect the things that actually matter. Your NAS, your laptop, your desktop, your phone.
So you have a long list, unfortunately, of things you want a router to do. This is one more to have the router support either they may call it VLANing. Edge Router X, for instance, from Ubiquiti, says you can make VLANs. Mm-hmm. It's a nice $50 router. Has four ports, PoE as well. But you would need a Wi-Fi router, but that's fine. You have the Wi-Fi on one port, VLAN away from another Wi-Fi access point that is for your... I'll tell you, the only problem with doing this, the reason I haven't done this, is you can't control those devices.
Yes.
Because my phone is on the secure internal network, but all the Alexa and the cameras and everything, they're on the secure other network, and they don't talk to each other for good reason, so I can't control them.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, what happens on my network, I don't use the three dumb router setup. I have a enterprise-level switch that creates a new VLAN for every device that's on the network.
Yeah.
And then it's decided what privileges those devices
should have. And you could have rules that say, oh, if you're seeing Sonos traffic, go ahead and route that in,
precisely,
stuff like that.
Yeah.
There's another, I also use a Wi-Fi system from Plume, and I imagine more and more of these mesh systems will do this. The Eero does not yet, to my knowledge. But the Plume allows you to set up, almost everybody allows you to set up a regular network and a guest network. That's not enough. A guest network communicates with the other network. But Plume has a third network called an internet-only network that allows a guest coming into the home, you give him this password, and he can do one thing, out. He can't go in. He can only go out to the internet. That, I think, would provide enough security. It's effectively a VLAN. So you would then give your IoT devices access to this internet-only network, and they wouldn't have access to your internal network. I haven't tried to see if I'd have access to them, but my guess is I wouldn't. This is the Plume. And you could see, I think if you look at... go back. You see it says home... on the home pass, home, guests, and internet only. And I suspect that would do the same thing as a three-dumb router setup. So I hope more and more routers do this. That should be a checklist when you buy a router next time. Yeah. That would help, right?
Yeah.
So I guess, he said I'm running Little Snitch. That's good, but the problem with Little Snitch is it watches outbound traffic from your Macintosh. It doesn't watch outbound traffic from your IoT device.
I've actually got something for that.
What's that?
So this is an old laptop, and actually if you go to this is a super easy way to make sure that you're not infected by Mirai. It's a service provided by Encapsula.
It actually scans for it.
It actually scans your network. So it's a free utility. It kind of works. I mean, it'll give you the basics. It's not super descriptive, but at least it will give you a warm and fuzzy. And by the way, that IP address, that's not the Twit IP address. That's a burner phone. So go ahead and attack it if you want to. But that's not what I want to show off. What I want to show off is another free tool. Last time I showed Nmap. This time I want to show
Nmap, everybody should
Wireshark.
Use. Oh, those two together, You got the toolkit. You really got it.
So Wireshark just looks at the wire. It watches the wire and it reports what it finds. So what I'm seeing here, this is some sample traffic that I've gotten. I've got this one device on my network, 10.0.2.15. Look how many requests it's making to so many different hosts. This is malware traffic. This is what malware traffic looks like. You've got one device that just keeps sweeping the range, sending packets, and I'm seeing a lot of ACK, not that much SYN. This is the kind of pattern that you would find from something like a Mirai or something that's trying to replicate. It's looking for open ports. It's looking for open services. It's looking for those devices that haven't been secured, and then it will report back via its probably IRC botnet command network and say, what do you want me to do? But to make this work, though, Leo, you need something called a tap, or that works like a tap. I've got a couple of devices.
This is a physical device.
This is a physical device. Because Little Snitch, as you mentioned, will only work on that
machine,
device.
Yeah.
Right. What I can do if I tap, I can actually tap an entire segment of the network. So all of these are enterprise class. So these, you probably aren't going to get these. These are NetOptics. These will run you like, you know, $1,000.
So how does this work? You put this on your network.
Right. So you got the cable coming in and going out.
Yeah.
And then I can tap either the inbound, the outbound, or the aggregated traffic. So I can see everything that passes on the line. But this doesn't actually, it's not part of the network. It doesn't have an IP address. It doesn't look like a device. It's just a spy. This does the same thing if you've got a fiber network.
So okay, if you've got fiber connect.
So the whole idea is being able to see the traffic without participating in the traffic. This is a more affordable one. You can get these for about $200. This is a Shark Tap. This is the one I like. It's a
200.
Gigabit.
Okay.
Right. It's a gigabit aggregated tap. You can also get a 10-100 for about $70.
So it's basically a pass-through, right?
But that one port at the bottom gives you everything that's passing through that wire. So if I have this between my main switch and my router, it will capture every communication between any device on my network and the internet.
Very nice.
Yeah.
So this is what you'd want to put Wireshark and Nmap on, the device connected to that tab.
Precisely.
Because then they're going to see everything that's happening.
Yeah. And I mean, I've got Nmap, I've got Wireshark running on a 11-year-old laptop.
Doesn't
need
much.
Yeah. You don't need much. You need a lot of space because it is capturing all the traffic. But it's a nice, easy way to make sure that nothing on your network is doing something it shouldn't be doing. In fact, every time I get a new device, I stick a tap on it and I watch it for a week.
Wow, that's good.
Just to see what it's sending. If I'm not doing anything with it and it's sending packets out into the internet, I'm worried.
And you could trust this.
Oh yeah,
this isn't going to get hacked.
No.
Okay, this is from Midbit Tech. MIDBITTECH.com.
Right. And if you want a 10-100 tap, you can actually make your own for about 45 cents.
It can't be that hard.
It's not that hard. Gigabit tap, yes. 10-100, no.
Okay. And you, truthfully, you probably don't have gigabit networking in your house.
Well, I mean, you might.
You have Cat 6E or something?
I would use the gigabit if you're trying to look at segments in your network, because you might have gigabit.
You might have.
But
yeah.
If you're just looking at what's going out to the internet,
10 gig. Yeah.
10-100 will work, because most of you don't have 100 megabit connections.
You don't need to go fast enough. Yeah. Wow. Well, that's a great question, Trent. I'm sorry you got bit by Mirai.
Ouch.
And I'm glad that you called and asked, because I think we've given you some really good ideas. A lot of pen testing distributions have Wireshark at Nmap. Kali Linux, for instance, it comes with a whole host of tools, including Wireshark at Nmap, so that you can then use all of those, put it on take an old machine, put Kali Linux on it, and it's really used by pen testers to go through the network and see what's going on. Pen stands for penetration. You're testing to see if you've been penetrated. Thank you, Father Robert. Usually people know, but if you don't know, then you use Kali. Next week, Jason Snell will be joining us. We'd love to get your questions for Mr. Six Colors, especially those Mac questions. Here's how you ask.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
Yes, yes, yes. Mailbag coming up. We've got some tributes to it. The passing of two people in our tech community this week. But before we go any farther, let's get part two of our visit to the World's Fair Nano.
The
The World's Fair Nano featured a lot of tech, but it also featured a glimpse at how the future might taste.
Do I want to try some algae-based nutritional bar?
I think you should. However, it's going to be a journey. It's like an intense experience. Some people cannot finish it. Some people are like, I love it.
Okay. That's very interesting.
Does it taste healthy?
Yeah, it absolutely does. Of course it does. It doesn't taste artificial. I mean, I never have considered what algae tastes like, but I suppose it tastes like this.
You're actually correct. We've kind of like complemented the flavor with something to be more palatable, but still you get that taste of ocean. It's definitely a new experience that you've never had before.
And you get the benefit of green teeth, which is not a bad thing.
Yeah. And tongue as well.
I don't get it. I don't understand Soylent.
It doesn't taste bad. It's just, it's very bland.
Oh, okay. Now I get it. I've been trying to interview them, and they just won't talk to me.
How do we inspire the next generation of future thinkers? Smart Girls was showcasing its platform for teaching young girls how to build their own understanding of the fundamentals of coding.
It uses what we're calling sugar-coded. It's a block system. It's very, very simple. You have commands over here that you can drag and drop and adjust. I'm going to show you something else, which I think is really cool. When you look at these blocks and then you look at the code behind it, you see the same numbers. You see words instead of the blocks themselves, and you realize it's not that big of a leap from doing this to real coding.
All centered around these small motorized toys that can perform a number of maneuvers based entirely upon the coding prowess of the user.
Your coding is obviously top-notch because she didn't go off the table.
She did fall once, which also proves she's very durable because she's back up there doing it again.
Why are there diodes in this banana?
And then we saw the team at WebGuys showing off how they're enabling young students to become adept in the ways of building things like virtual reality environments, as well as, well, inserting strange probes into bananas for dramatic and educational effect.
You tap a banana, you're making some music.
Mycroft AI was there with its own smart home assistant platform, totally open source because, well, why should all of the tech giants have all the fun, especially when these home assistants are being scrutinized for how secure and how private they may or may not be?
We don't collect any information off the voice interactions. We do have an opt-in for people who trust us. They want to contribute their data to our data sets to help improve the experience. And then customizable. I mean, you see here we can do, some different colors. You can change the name and the wake word. You can change the voice. All our hardware is open hardware, hackable hardware. So take the schematics, adjust them a little bit, put it on the head of your robot, take the guts out and put them in a different device.
It looks like Amy is free at 5 p.m. today.
Some of the stuff that really sings to me personally is what we're seeing in the way of audio technology and how that merges with experiential control systems and visual representations, which is what LoveTech had on tap. They had this really cool booth that allowed you to talk to a person on the other side of the booth through a microphone with all of these really crazy audio effects and play around on an XY axis. Really cool stuff. But they also had this cool oscilloscope setup.
There's a whole variety of sounds, and what you're seeing is actually what the sound looks like. The left channel goes up and down with the electron gun, and the right channel goes left and right, and it's showing it really quickly, but that's exactly what the sound looks like.
You're seeing a spaceship here. I imagine you created the sound from the picture in that case, right?
Well, it goes in both directions. So there's a really wonderful piece of software. Jarrod Beam-Fenderson is like one of the pioneers of this whole art form. And the software lets you import three-dimensional models and see what they hear what they sound like. And also go in the opposite direction where you synthesize new sounds and see what they look like.
Right.
So from that dual perspective, you can generate sounds that, you know, look this amazing.
Overall, it was an absolute blast wandering the pier, examining, enjoying, and in some cases consuming what may have one day been thought of as the future. What's more exciting is that the future, as evidenced by what I saw with my own eyes last weekend, is now.
Oh, robotic beer pong.
Now there's a game I can get behind.
We didn't tell Jason that those were actually chocolate edibles infused with cannabis, so he won't be coming into the office for a while.
He seemed awfully happy.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's weird.
Now, I drink a beverage with algae in it. Algae oil in it. Yeah.
Is that Soylent stuff?
That's that Soylent stuff.
I tried it, and it tasted like chalk to me.
Just the soy part. The algae tastes like kind of queasy fish oil.
See, my grandfather on my mother's side actually used to do this shake, this algae shake, and it smelled disgusting.
Yeah, that's spirulina. That was spirulina. That was
horrible.
Big in my day. Yeah,
it was
with the
horrible.
Kids. Yeah. I don't know. All right. So we had a couple of sad events. Stephen Hawking, of course, passed away at the age of 76. Really kind of an amazing life. I hope everybody saw The Theory of Everything, where Eddie Redmayne plays the young Stephen Hawking and then discovers he has ALS and degenerates. And it really is impressive that here's a guy who lived for 50 years with ALS, which is normally a death sentence, right? And thanks to technology, was able to communicate. Hawking would give speeches, and the first thing he would do, he'd come on stage in his chair, and of course he had this very sophisticated, eventually, it was late at the end by IBM and Watson, speech synthesis. And the first thing he would always say, it was kind of endearing, is, can you hear me? Here's a tribute that was created for Hawking, Professor Hawking, at his 75th birthday. We thought this would be the best way to say goodbye.
Can you hear me? It has been a glorious time to be alive and doing research in theoretical physics. Our picture of the universe has changed a great deal in the last 50 years, and I'm happy if I have made a small contribution. The fact that we humans, who are ourselves mere collections of fundamental particles of nature, have been able to come this close to an understanding of the laws governing us and our universe is a great triumph. I want to share my excitement and enthusiasm about this quest. So remember to look up at the stars and not down at your feet. Try to make sense of what you see, and wonder about what makes the universe exist. Be curious. And however difficult life may seem, there is always something you can do, and succeed at. It matters that you don't just give up. Thank you for listening.
Very inspiring. And of course, here's a guy whose body completely failed him, but his mind continued on.
And I remember, as you know, in high school, we were talking about Hawking, and it was this idea of, would he have as big of a voice in the scientific community if his body hadn't failed him?
Yeah.
It really allowed him to focus. It really allowed him to concentrate on the things that were important, and it made people pay attention to the ideas. And, you know, it's... As much as Einstein was to the previous generation, Hawking was to us.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I read his history.
Brief History of Time.
And it was one of these sort of eureka moments of, yeah, it's okay to think things that have never been thought before.
He was highly recommended. And what a wonderful book to have to read your kids.
Yeah.
And I would recommend this and discuss with them. He talks a lot about, he was a theorist in black holes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fascinating to read. And it reminded me of Wordsworth's famous quote about Sir Isaac Newton. I wanted to look it up because I wanted to get it right. A mind forever voyaging through strange seas of thought.
Yeah.
And I think that is the best way to memorialize Stephen Hawking, a really great man. And we were very lucky to have lived in a time when he existed. Now let's talk about the other person. And this, we just got this news yesterday.
Right.
A little bit devastating, a Facebook post from his father,
mm-hmm.
who was sad to announce to the world that Adrian Lamo had passed away at the age of 37. We still don't know how he died. He was in Kansas. Adrian was forever voyaging for other reasons. He was a homeless hacker.
Yeah.
We called him the homeless hacker. We interviewed him several times on the new screensavers. He's actually been on the old screensavers. He's actually been on the new screensavers as well. I believe he was diagnosed with Asperger's.
Yeah.
And I think it was one of the things that characterized his kind of peculiar inability to understand why people didn't like what he did.
Yeah.
One of the things that Adrian was known for, he would couch surf. He wouldn't have a regular place of abode. Whenever it got uncomfortable for him, he'd couch surf to somewhere else. That's how he ended up in Kansas. And he also liked to do pen testing. And something we all love, but he would get in trouble for it because he wouldn't ask permission first. He'd break into people's systems at the New York Times, at Microsoft, and then tell them, oh, you've got a problem here, at which point they, well, eventually had him arrested in 2004.
Yeah, he was at the front of that curve, where it's better now. It's not perfect, but it's better in that companies don't automatically treat a hacker as the enemy. Sometimes a hacker is trying to responsibly disclose that there's something wrong with their service. Now, the second time you had him on the old screensavers, I think you actually talked to him from jail because he had just
He wasn't
been
in
arrested.
Jail yet. He had decided to, in fact, actually, we have a little clip of this. He had decided to turn himself in, but he hadn't done so yet.
Okay.
He'd been indicted for, and this was in 2004, for hacking Microsoft
and
the
New York Times.
Watch.
Yeah.
Adrian, what happened?
It's really hard to say. I've not been given a lot of information at this time, but about a week and a half ago, I was given information that led me to believe that the FBI was researching me. And as of 2 days ago, the FBI has in fact tipped its hand and given me solid reason to know that they want to have a word with me.
How did you find out? Dana told me that they came to your parents' house?
They went to my parents' house, where I do not live, and I think that's just the best address that they could figure out for me. They went there on the hope that I would be there, and they badgered my parents a bit. They wanted to search the premises. My mother, whom I'm very proud of in this regard, refused to let the FBI agents in, and they threatened to come back with a search warrant, which...
So we're talking to Adrian Lamo. You saw, of course, the dark tipper, Kevin Rose, with me. That's the old screensavers. We had Adrian on the new screensavers not so long ago, maybe a year ago. So the thing about Adrian that is most controversial about him is that he turned in then Bradley Manning.
Now Chelsea Manning.
Now Chelsea Manning. Chelsea ended up serving 7 years in federal prison. Her sentence was commuted by President Obama, so she's no longer in prison. In fact, Chelsea's running for Congress, which I find fascinating. But I think a lot of the hacking community was very angry at Adrian.
It's sad that that's going to define his legacy.
To some people, he's
a hero who turned in a traitor. And to some people, he's a demon who turned in someone who was doing something to make the country better. And I don't think you don't do that. Don't do that. Here was a person who was curious. And he may not be a Stephen Hawking, but he did things differently, and he tried things differently, and he obviously had talent and competency in what he did. Celebrate that.
Yeah. I do think he was probably a troubled man.
He was.
We don't know what happened. We know it wasn't foul play, at least the police in Kansas City or wherever it was, Wichita said that it wasn't foul play, but we don't know what else happened. But I'm sure we'll find out at some point.
And he was always a private person. So, I mean, it would be horrific if suddenly people are camping out to get all the salacious details. He's gone. He has passed.
And we're sorry.
Yeah.
I think in retrospect, Adrian didn't feel he had a choice, that he had to turn Chelsea Manning in. And I think that that's somewhat related to his diagnosis of Asperger's. I don't think he grasped the nuance of it, and I think he saw it in black and white, and that this was the requirement, and so he did that. And I don't think he did it out of maliciousness, to be honest with you.
It was an impossible situation, and I would dare anybody to put themselves in that exact situation and make a decision that's not going to piss off at least half the people you know.
So, I have to say he was a friend. We knew him well, and we're sorry to lose him. So, R.I.P. Adrian. And, of course, R.I.P. Stephen Hawking. He is a mind forever voyaging.
Yeah.
I love that line.
The universe is a little bit more known because of him, and I think that's the best thing you can ever say about any scientist.
Yeah. Let's get the mailbag in here. Colleen, push it in. Crash. Crash into my stuff, will you? Here you go, Father Robert.
I'll
pick
take
one.
That one.
I shall pick the other. All you get email number one.
I've got one, and it's from Ken, who says... Hi, Leo and Padre. Do you know of a smartphone that is not made in China? Either the parts are made in China or the phone is assembled in China, providing an opportunity for state tampering. Thanks for your answer, Ken.
That's a great question.
It is.
I do know quite a few phones that are not made in China because, as it turns out, Samsung phones are made in Korea.
Correct.
There are a lot of phones made in the Philippines. Even iPhones, some iPhones are made in Brazil. This was a deal that Apple had to make with Brazil to get the tariffs down on the iPhone. If you make it in Brazil, then you can sell it in Brazil without a massive tariff. Mm-hmm. Same thing's going to happen in India. They're going to make them in India for the same reason, for tariffs. But I guess my recommendation would be the Samsung. The S9 I just showed you, I think, is an excellent phone made in Korea. There may be, let's see, Toshiba's Japanese.
Japanese.
I don't think
Samsung
there are any.
Samsung is Korean.
Yeah, I think it's all not China.
Yeah, there is an issue, though, about where the fabs are located, and that's tough.
You'd have to do some research.
You'd have to do a lot of research to make sure that particular model is not using any parts from
if
China.
That's what you care about.
Now, yeah, it's tough.
And also make the distinction between Taiwan and China. A lot of, yes, like TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which makes many of the Apple chips, that's in Taiwan. That's not China. They speak Chinese.
It's ROC.
It's a complicated thing. But the main point is that the Chinese government in the mainland China does not influence what's going on in Taiwan. That is a democratic republic. So I wouldn't worry about Taiwan. Of course, you can get phones made by Sony in Japan. I think there are a lot of choices. You don't have to get a phone that has been anywhere near mainland China. Do you worry, though? I think, frankly, Apple probably does a lot of checking on those iPhones to make sure they've not been tampered with.
And here's the thing. I actually applaud this. I like it when people want to know where their tech comes from.
Fair
enough. It when people are interested in security issues.
Fair enough.
But the device itself isn't going to be the problem. It's the transit. That's when information is actually in transit. It's moving from or to your device.
Yeah.
Those networks are run almost entirely by parts that are made in China. So, I mean, if you're really going to go and be a Chinaphobe,
all the switches.
Yeah.
And furthermore, it doesn't have to just be China. What about Facebook? Do you have Facebook on your phone? They're watching you. I don't know if I trust them less or more than China, to be honest with you.
And I mean, China isn't currently currently trying to mandate a backdoor for all encryption. That's our government. So that's probably a bit more important.
Actually, China
right now
doesn't need to. They probably have it. HTC is made in Taiwan. HTC is a Taiwanese company. LG is a Korean company. I think a lot of phones actually don't go anywhere near China. Email 2. If I change my... Oh, this is for you.
Oh, good.
If I change my local computer's DNS lookup to 9.9.9.9. That's Steve Gibson's been talking about that. It's called Quad 9. And they do some, but not a total filtering of the DNS traffic. And my router has a different DNS lookup address, which has precedent. Oh, that's a good thing.
Good
so
question.
He's changing his computer.
Right, so his network settings on his computer.
But the router has a different one.
Yep.
What's he going to get?
It's always going to be the local client. Okay. So your local client overrides what the router has, because the router, when you put the DNS settings in the router, that doesn't mean that any traffic going through that router will automatically use that DNS server. It means that any computer that makes a DNS request to that router will use that the configured DNS server.
Right.
If your client already has a DNS server in its network settings, it will ignore the router entirely. It will just send the DNS request straight to 9.9.9.9 or 8.8.8.8 or 208.67.222.222, whatever server
you have
you're
memorized
using.
All of the other DNS
you have
servers.
To. That's, it's a
That's OpenDNS was
skill.
The last one, and Quad 8 is Google?
8.8.8 is Google, right.
Google, 8.8.8. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's...
What's like, Verizon?
Quad 4. No, never use Verizon.
Well, if you want somebody to spy on everything you do...
Don't use Verizon, don't use Comcast, don't use AT&T. But if you put something in the router settings, and you've all seen that, that's the startup screen, all that is the setting that will be given to a client if they make a DHCP request.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and the rules are sometimes non-intuitive. Steve Gibson did a whole segment on this on a Security Now a couple of weeks back because somebody had a similar question. And I always assumed, well, the computer first looks in the DNS cache on the computer. Some recent searches are stored in the cache.
Right.
If you can't find that, then it looks in the hosts file. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think Steve said, no, hosts first, then cache. And if it can't find it there, then it says, well, what's the DNS server? And if the computer knows, it goes out to that DNS server, Quad 9 in your case, and finds out. If the computer says, I don't have a DNS server, let's ask the router.
Right.
The router may have already cached that information, in which case the router will give it back. But if it doesn't, then it will go to its DNS server. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't have an address, it will go to the ISP's DNS server. If the ISP says, I don't know, then they move all the way up to the 13 root servers. And that's how the magic happens. But the rules are not just like that.
No.
And that's, I was a little surprised when Steve explained it. So if you really want to kind of go do a deep dive, if you don't have Father Robert at your house tonight, then you should probably go to the Security Now show.
I hope you don't have Father Robert at your house tonight.
Well, somebody does.
I'm going to get in trouble.
Somebody does. I'm sure you're staying somewhere. Best way to find out, I don't remember which show number it is, but here's what a great thing now everybody should know about. That's grc.com. That's Steve's site. You know that he does written transcripts mm-hmm. of all of his shows. And you can search those transcripts on Google. So you cite grc.com and then do a search, and it will give you the Security Now episode based on that transcript. So you could search for Quad 9. He talks quite a bit about Quad 9, and he's dressed quite dapperly there. And he also talked a lot about the DNS rules. I think if you Google DNS rules and Security Now, you probably find it.
So can I start calling you number one?
Who is number one?
Riker.
I am number two. You are number nine. I don't know. Riker, yeah. So there was a couple of good questions. I'm glad you were here to answer them.
It was fun.
Robert, as you might have gathered, is pretty geeky. He knows a lot. And you can find out what he knows on a couple of different shows. twit.tv/KH. That's for Know-How.
Know-How.
And then he does This Week in Enterprise Tech, which is all about enterprise. And covers a lot of these same subjects. T-W-I-E-T, twit.tv/T-W-I-E-T. And I love having you on this show because you raise the intelligence quotient quite a bit.
Well, it's fun, although I have to say when both of us are on the show, they tend to be the longest shows ever.
Well, this was a mere two-hour show. I don't consider that. You obviously don't listen to many of our shows. 2 hours is nothing. Nothing. Thank you for being here, Father.
Thank you for having me.
Really appreciate it. Thank you all for watching. We do the new Screensavers on a Saturday afternoon right after I do the radio show. So that's usually starting around 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. You can figure out what your time zone is from that. You can watch live if you do at twit.tv/live. I invite you to join us in the chat room, too, where the kids in the back of the class are throwing spitballs. That's irc.twit.tv. Actually, it's a lot of fun. It's the best way to watch the shows is with the IRC going at the same time. If you're not here to watch live, you can always watch on demand. Everything we do is available on demand. Really, that's what a podcast is, right? Just go to twit.tv, in this case, twit.tv/NSS, and you can download audio or video of every show we've done. Every show is on that website. And if you want to kind of keep up, subscribe. Find your favorite podcatcher. I like Pocket Casts. Overcast on iOS is very popular. iTunes. Whatever, the podcast apps from Google, the Google Music and so forth. Whatever you use, just subscribe to the new Screensavers. And that way, look, we even have a way to watch it on the Zune. Subscribe on your Zune.
I was looking for my brown Zune. I think I've lost it.
You had a brown
I had a brown Zune.
That was the best Zune.
Awesome.
Whatever way you get it, please do get it every week because we would love to see you back here on the new Screensavers. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Yeah!